Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Today, writer and poet Luis Urrea on what it means to be an American. This is a series in which I'm asking activists, authors, musicians, and more to reflect on that question. Luis Urrea is an award-winning poet, novelist, and nonfiction writer. He's a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame, and his newest novel is titled Into the Beautiful North. I've asked all of our guests for the series to begin by considering a phrase from a Langston Hughes poem. The poem is Let America Be America Again, and the lines from the poem are Let America Be the Dream the Dreamers Dreamed. I asked Luis what that phrase said to him.
You know, it's interesting because the country doesn't seem monolithic to me. It seems like a whole galaxy of small interactions and communities. And for somebody like me, you know, I came from, as you probably know, I was born in Tijuana in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I came from a little dirt street neighborhood known as the Colony of Independence, which if you think about it is kind of American in a way, and came here at an early age and was in a kind of a tough barrio situation. In fact, the same neighborhood that Juan Felipe Herrera, our poet laureate, came from. Hmm. But we were at opposite ends of National Avenue. Uh-huh. But if you think about those things, just the two of us, I think that is the embodiment of that line of Mr. Hughes, you know, that I lived fueled and driven by dreams. And they kept changing. They kept changing as I sort of went from island to island of possibility and redefinition. I think that other islands showed themselves to me. And so that poem to me is extremely timely, particularly in the situation I think we find ourselves in now. And if one looks at, for example, the patterns of immigration, it's about dreaming. It's about the dream that drives people forward. It's not necessarily, I don't think, about what the paranoia would state, you know, that people are coming to take jobs or steal services or so on. It's a dream. It's a dream of possibility.
Luis, I find that image of you moving from island to island of possibilities interesting because I know what lies between those islands, and sometimes that's pretty rough water.
Yeah, it
right?
was.
it was. So tell me.
It was. It was, in some senses, I think it was a storm of confusion and dashed hope and lots of hopelessness. You know, I came to the United States because I was dying of tuberculosis. So talk about coming in humbled circumstances, you know, from our dirt street barrio there with plenty of outhouses and so forth. And coming in and settling in a rough and tumble neighborhood that was full of ethnic strife and poverty. And I actually... This may mean something to you in light of our conversation, but I was, as soon as we got to the United States, given a series of rules by my family. One of the rules was do not admit to anybody that we're from Tijuana.
Really?
Because it's shameful. And certainly don't admit to anybody that you were sick. I was ill not only with tuberculosis, but scarlatina and German measles all at once. And I had developed sort of poverty, barrio skin diseases and had hideous things happening all over my body as a little baby, a little kid. I was probably 3 and a half when we came. So never tell anybody you were sick. And don't ever tell people that we were struggling financially, which I thought was kind of funny because it was fairly obvious to everybody in the neighborhood that we were all in the same boat. But, you know, both of my parents had this wish to go forward. He was Mexican. She was American. And she was originally from, you know, I think a good social standing in the world. And so she was always striving to get back to the place she felt she had fallen from. And my father was trying to always assert, I think, his qualities as a fellow human being. And at a certain point in that neighborhood, we had to leave. And it was due to some ethnic violence that involved me in fourth grade. And I didn't know any better. I didn't know what the world was except that world. And I was essentially chased down the street by someone with a switchblade knife. It was like a scene from Peary Thomas, you know, down these mean streets. I didn't know any, you know, I was no tough guy. I was trying to be a Jesuit priest. And I came out of, you know, my Catholic school, and I was walking down the street trying to get to our sad little apartment in one piece. It was about a 3/4 of a mile walk. And an older fellow started beating me up. And when I resisted, he pulled a knife. And I did escape. But it was clear that we needed to get out of that world. And we ended up moving north, semi-ironically, I guess. We had come north once. And then for further rescue went further north and went up to this white working class suburb, which to me was like going to heaven. I'd never seen anything like it. I just got back from speaking in Texas near Dallas. I was speaking to 500 Latino kids. Mm-hmm. And I told them I never saw green lawns until the fifth grade. And it was a shock.
You know what else occurs to me in the story of your sickness and the motivation for your parents to bring you out of Mexico and into the United States was there was a lot of shame and secrecy laying over kind of what was probably a sort of mythology to your parents about what it was going to mean to be in America.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think as you see in the poem as well, there was a kind of a double message, right? Because as soon as I was established in this new neighborhood and I became more American, my dad ramped up the Mexicanness. All of a sudden Mexico became the Shangri-La, the best place on earth. And if you go in to the immigrant communities and you see a lot of the families that are here, dreamers, by the way, those students, their parents have this heartbroken memory of what was and what could have been back home.
Will you explain that a bit more to me?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, I write about this a lot in my books, but you know, imagine leaving the place you love, the place you grew up, you know, the place where that bend in the river is and where you would walk around the plaza saying lovely things to the opposite sex when you were younger. We have a phrase in Spanish called piropos. Piropos are when you say these dashing poetic things to young ladies if you're a young gentleman. And all of the rituals, you know, all of the feasts and all of the the dances and the way things are celebrated. And then, and you're a human being, by the way. In Tijuana, we were human beings. And I did not know that Mexicans were something less than human beings in the public mind until fifth grade. I saw green lawns, and I liked to joke with the kids that I ate sliced bread for the first time. No more corn tortilla peanut butter sandwiches. It was on bread. But I also found out that we were called all these names I'd never heard. And I think about these children that I speak to now who turn on the TV and in a presidential campaign hear that they're rapists and murderers and so forth. It was a shock, and I think it intensified levels of shame in both of my parents and my mother's urge. She was a very conservative Republican, oddly enough, in her situation, but she always wanted me to, you know, grow up and somehow fit into some Eisenhower mold. It wasn't going to happen. And my father was suddenly deeply shamed of something that he had been proud of to the point of chauvinistic fervor his entire life, which was Mexico.
And that was his heritage.
His heritage and his language. Wow. And it began a war in our home. It started even back in the first barrio in San Diego, where, you know, she championed English and he championed Spanish. And it was a really difficult upbringing for me in a way, kind of like being in boot camp, in that I got two upbringings at the same time and they were at war with each other. So I was expected to be an American boy and speak perfect English. At the same time, I was expected to be a Mexican young man speaking perfect Spanish. And later on, it turned out to be a great thing for me. It helped me, I think, develop in ways that I might not have. But that aspiration was there. And by the time we got to that suburb I'm telling you about is when my parents, their one greatest gift to me aside from language or two languages was a love of reading. Hmm. And my mania, I think, for reading and then for music. I'm wearing a Bob Dylan t-shirt as I speak to you. And, you know, Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and John Lennon and people like that were great writing teachers. I didn't know they were. Jim Morrison. And I can tell you the song that made me understand how impossibly powerful both, I think, language and message, because it was a song about utter frustration and prophecy, and that was, "It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding."
So don't fear if you hear a foreign sound to your ear. It's all right, Ma, I'm only sighing.
So when I got there and I had access to more books than I used to have, that's when this other thing began, that I wanted to do art, I wanted to do poetry, I wanted to do stories, and that was the next island. And everything in my life, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda in Hamilton, at one point Hamilton says, "I wrote my way out." That was me. I felt that viscerally. I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I didn't know what it was going to be, but it was going to be in the arts because I was incapable of anything else. You know, by the time I got certainly to junior high school and the ruptures became evident to me in my own being, I was being called greaser and wetback and taco bender and all these things, and my family was being disparaged, and what I thought had been my culture was being disparaged. And it was at a time of great tumult, the 68 era, you know, 67, 68, 69 era, when I was coming into those places. I just felt, you know, what the Germans might call Weltschmerz. You know, I felt this world sorrow and this feeling of being trapped. And that song spoke to that because it was this explosion of intelligence and verbiage and rhyme and outrage and resignation and those constant refrains through that song back to his mother, which were both caring and angry. I think those were all things I couldn't express. I didn't know how to express them, but I felt them. I didn't even know what I was feeling, but I felt them. And I didn't know until later, I think, that a lot of it was about, you know, the original dream, you know, and being Mexican.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to our What It Means to Be an American series conversation today with writer and poet Luis Urrea. He's an award-winning poet, novelist, and nonfiction writer. He's a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame, and his newest novel is titled Into the Beautiful North. You know, given your writing and the fact that you often explore what it means to leave familiarity, leave a country that means a lot to you, I'm interested in how you think of home.
How I think of home.
What home is?
You know, that was a shifting definition for sure, because home wasn't all that much fun for a very long time. And I thought I would never escape the hopelessness in which I found myself. And there was this miracle, two miracles actually. When I did go to college, I was the first of my family to go to college. And I think college was the beginning of the massive turn into the world. I was very blessed to be discovered by Ursula Le Guin. She came to the college and basically saw me and saw my work and took me in and began sort of training me to be a writer. She published, you know, she was my first sale. She published a story of mine in an anthology and sort of shaped me up and smacked me around and scolded me into formation.
That isn't an extraordinary experience for someone.
Oh my God.
Who is just finding his voice, as I'm sure you were, to have someone of her authority and stature to see something in you and yet shape you, as you say, right?
Yes, she I think she really made me understand and own the fact that if you're a writer, perhaps your true home is in that. Regardless of what happens to you or where you are or what your circumstances are. In some ways, one doesn't understand the hugeness of what's happening, because Ursula was delightful, was caring, was brilliant, was terrifying. But, you know, for example, I was lucky enough to take her to see Star Wars the first time she saw it. Can you imagine? I mean, you know, I sitting with Le Guin in a movie theater and having her explain the science mistakes during the film was, I'll never forget it. And the other thing that was, I'd say the second part of this astonishment was in 1982, I was hired to go teach expository writing at Harvard, which, you know, if there is such a thing as a secular miracle, that was it. Because there's no way, you know, a Colonia Independencia boy was going to go to Harvard even as a student, I don't think. And there I was going off to teach expository writing. And that moment was what exploded my concept, I think, of home and of the United States. Because I thought up until that moment that I was a border rat and I would always be in San Diego, kind of against my will, because I had this universal urge to see everything, but I couldn't do it. All of a sudden, I was standing there in New England, and I had entered my mother's world. And I realized that I had been trying to honor my father and my father's people and my father's culture my entire life. And all of a sudden, I was walking around Boston thinking, wait, this is me too. And I met my mother's relatives, which was astonishing to me. I had never met them. And I suddenly realized that it was all for me. It was all there. And I could inhabit the United States of America. I can't tell you how powerful that was. It changed everything. And now that I lead a very public life, I am, you know, blessed with a happy, healthy, joyous, actual home and a family that loves to be together. And now that I'm getting older, I may be getting more boring because all I want to do is stay home at my house. And that's a really fantastic thing, something I didn't have before.
I couldn't help but note that you were using the word miracle, and you noted that going to Harvard was a secular miracle. And you've reminded me that, you know, America is a country founded by people who felt oppressed because of their religious views. That was one of the motivations. Does faith in any way fit into the equation for you of what it means to be an American?
It does. It does for me. I think I'm often misidentified as a political writer. And, you know, those old Jesuitic roots, I think, stay true. I'm really interested in our spiritual journey. I guess one would have to accept the conceit that we do have souls, actually. But I see myself on a spiritual quest much more than any kind of political quest. And I think that's the secret ingredient in the stuff I write. And I try to keep it non-preachy, but I do think it's a particularly American thing. And a lot of my American heroes have been people who've dealt with those issues.
Who are those heroes?
Oh, so many. So many. Mostly authors, I guess, but many politicians, some theologians, certainly artists and musicians, people who have, brought hope and a touch of grace. I think if you look around the atmosphere we're in now, aside from propaganda during the election, bandy those words around, a sense of grace, decency, and dignity to people seems to be in short supply at the moment. And if you could go with me and talk to all these hundreds and hundreds of young Latino kids that I see, you'll see that they're in a lot of ways brokenhearted and afraid and ashamed and reconciling themselves to a shadow life that they don't have to lead. And that, to me, is spiritual work, telling them, no, that's not true. This is who you are, and this is why you're sacred right now, as you are, sins and all.
I thought it would be interesting to listen to something that President Obama said in Selma earlier this year. He gave a speech where he was also reflecting on what it means to be an American. And here's just a short excerpt from that.
That's what America is. Not stock photos or airbrushed history or feeble attempts to define some of us as more American than others. We respect the past, but we don't pine for the past. We don't fear the future. We grab for it. America's not some fragile thing. We are large, in the words of Whitman, containing multitudes. We are boisterous and diverse and full of energy, perpetually young in spirit.
Luis, what does that say to you?
Four more years. No. I agree. Young in spirit. I'll tell you a really vivid example of all of those things to me. My mother, in World War II, was in the Red Cross, and she was in a group called the Clubmobile Corps, also known as Donut Dollies. And these were women who've been written out of history, but they were there. They were in the Battle of the Bulge. They were in the Siege of Bastogne. They were women who drove into combat and made coffee and donuts for the GIs and played them records and gave them counsel. And as far as I know, all but one of the women are gone. And the last one was my mother's best friend and her truck driver. And she lives astonishingly about 2 miles from our house.
Is that right?
And she's 98 years old, and we go and visit her. And when you go in to see her, it's still 1945 in her apartment. You know, Glenn Miller is playing endlessly. And she has even the map that she followed as she drove the truck in her apartment. And we sit together and we talk, and she tells us these stories about what it was like. And you can see in her face that she went out there and saved the world. And it's kind of sweet because she likes Manhattans. So when she has a Manhattan, she calls it a joy juice. And as soon as she has a sip of the joy juice, 58 of those 98 years fall away. And if she could, she would dance again. And she's full of all of this light and all of this love and all of this bravery. And she would go back and defend the country again if she could. So, you know, when I hear the president talk about that, I know, because I see people like this all the time. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what political party you're in or if you're liberal or conservative. You know, I have to go talk to thousands of people all the time. And they're always welcoming, barring, you know, there are always strange characters who send you threatening anonymous emails or messages on social media. But regardless of the audience or the makeup of it or the belief system of those audiences, they seem to really care, and they're concerned, and they want to hear. And they will listen, even if they don't agree with me, about what it is I have to say about folks that sometimes they're scared of or suspicious of or angry about. And that fills me with hope. If I turn on the TV, I feel nothing but despair. But when I go out and meet people face to face, I feel a little bit like we're in family.
Mi corazón me recuerda que de llorar por el tiempo que se ha ido, por el que se va.
I was thinking about what you said about speaking to those young Latino men and women, kids, many of them, about how they feel heartbroken in a lot of ways, and what the president said about determining that some people are more American than others. Where does that fit together for you, for those kids? How do you think they take that in?
I watch these kids. For example, in Irving, Texas, last week, you know, 500 kids, a whole bunch of those kids, ROTC kids, going into the Marine Corps to serve the United States. You know, and they come here with stories that their teachers don't know. They don't understand what has driven a lot of these families. And so many towns all over the United States feel like they're under a certain siege because the demographic has changed so radically. Yet the rapper, the accent, the affect just contains a human heart. And so many of those young people are just looking for that embrace that makes them love the community they're in and feel loved and seen by that community, which is then waiting to grow into that love and embrace for the entire nation. And I think you're going to see it happen. I think it's happening more and more. I'm seeing people doing really brilliant things to be inclusive. The slightest inclusion, the slightest taste of the American dream, which I believe, in spite of propaganda, is still active and powerful, transforms people. And, you know, when you listen to that talk of the president's or watch it, he's smiling. He's laughing. And that smile, you know, that moment of sparkle means so much to those kids. And for me, now that you know where I come from, just imagine being the first author for 500 of little me's, the first book they've read. Or as one kid said, well, you're the first book I ever finished. They start them, but they don't finish them because they have to. That is incredible. And to feel like you can write something and tell somebody, it's okay, I see you, I know you. In some sense, I am you, or at least my nieces and nephews are. And this is a place for you too. Just be brave.
Do you think enough Americans have accepted the idea that we the people, that very essential phrase from our Constitution, is changing? The idea and the ideal of what we the people is has to change, and it's good that it changes.
It shifts. It's another one of those islands. You know, we look to the horizon and we move toward things. And I think it's always a choice. We can move toward fire, brimstone, and smoke, or we can move toward a garden. It's our decision. And, you know, I do think it's changing. You see it changing. You see people adjusting. And hello, it's been the message from the beginning on this continent. And, you know, I always get this line, and sometimes I feel fed up, so I respond snarkily, but people tell me, you know, my ancestors came here, but they brought documents. They were legal when they came here. And I, when I'm in a snarky mood, say, well, who checked those papers? Was it Crazy Horse or Geronimo? Because, you know, according to which original inhabitant. And it's just something that you know, is constantly evolving, and it's constantly changing. And believe me, the stories, if you could actually speak to someone who would tell you what motivated coming here, it's jaw-dropping. And I'm going to tell you now that 15-year-old teenaged girl in the high school class that loves Justin Bieber and chews bubblegum in class, but is Mexican, and you assume a certain thing drove her here. When you find out the true story, if she or her parents can ever confide in you, you know, as has happened for me, it would blow your mind. I was at a school district near where we live. We live in a suburb of Chicago, Naperville, and in one of the high schools, the teachers had a brilliant idea. They had all these Spanish-speaking kids, dreamers, and they asked me to come have lunch with them and speak in Spanish. And the English teachers would sit in with the Spanish faculty, and the Spanish teachers would translate for them what the conversation was.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, that child, that 15-year-old girl with the frizzy hair and the cute little outfits and all that, sitting eating pizza with me, and told me the story that not only had her father been disappeared in the middle of the night, bad men came and dragged him from his bed, and she never saw him again. But after that happened, they cut a man's throat in front of her, and the blood actually hit her school uniform. And that's when she and her mother knew that they would not survive. They would be killed. And so the whole accepted mythos of coming to America for a better life, or coming to America for work, collapses. They came to the United States for life. Period. I've got to say, it's going back to faith. It's something one can find very vividly in scriptures. We claim to be big Bible people, and I always challenge people, let's do a Bible off and find out where scripture tells you not to care for a refugee, not to clothe the naked or care for the widow or feed the hungry. You're going to lose because there are no such verses. So then what? That's the issue we face.
You've also reminded me that, and I think you said that the mythos of this is all about economics, it's all about finding the kind of work on this side of the border that you can't find on that side of the border, I think is something that even well-intentioned Americans might let themselves believe to be distanced in some ways from the kind of story that that 15-year-old girl told you. I think it makes it easier, right, to say, you stay there, we'll stay here, and we'll do what we can from this side.
Yeah, it is easier. And I had all kinds of class rage when I was a young firebrand, and I had all kinds of, you know, judgmental thoughts. And I understand now that it is almost impossible to process the levels of not only pain, but humanity, just someone else's humanity. And so I try to do it the easy way. I try to write entertaining or involving, or even if I can, beautiful texts through which we can sit and look at each other just eye to eye and maybe laugh together. I think if you laugh together, amazing things happen. It's very difficult to then walk away from that table saying, wow, those people are garbage. Not when you've truly looked in each other's eyes and had a laugh, because once that happens, you can also cry together. And, you know, there is only so much we can do. But sometimes I think it's enough to just be aware. Sometimes it's enough to just be conscious, because who knows what little crack will open for some light to pour through.
You're listening to our What It Means to Be an American series with writer and poet Luis Urrea. He's an award-winning poet, novelist, and nonfiction writer. He's a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame, and his newest novel is titled Into the Beautiful North. I want to ask you if there is a writer or a poet who embodies this this quest for the American ideal for you. I mean, we started with this poem from Langston Hughes, but who is it that really speaks to this for you in literature?
Oh, there's so many. You know, there's so many, and some of them would seem obscure in some ways, but you could certainly go to good old Walt Whitman and start, you know, moving down the highway with him.
Okay, but that now that surprises me that he is the poet you would go to.
Well, he was, you know, when you're learning, when you're first reading poems, that's who they give you. They give you, you know, by the shores of Gitche-Gumee and some Walt Whitman. And so I wasn't a big poetry fan when I was a kid.
Really?
It was through music that humanized it. And then I discovered poetry as I went. But, you know, yeah, I mean, there are so many people, I think, that have this spirit of possibility, this spirit of hope. You know, Ray Bradbury, for crying out loud, even Willa Cather, you know, even Mad Jack Kerouac. There was this, I always find myself carried by enthusiasm and attention, an eye for attention, an eye for what is good. And that doesn't mean, you know, discounting anger or discounting social criticism or so forth. I think, for example, a book like I mentioned earlier, Down These Mean Streets by Peary Thomas, is quite transformative and quite beautiful. And I teach it here in Chicago to students who've never read it or never had heard of him. And I think they find it really eye-opening. And I would say my homie Juan Felipe Herrera right now, the poet laureate, is just a powerful advocate for humanity, seen through perhaps our lens, but it's available to all citizens to see. And he's doing fantastic work out there, you know, for the U.S. and for literature and for people in general. Yeah, I could go on all day long.
Is it O Pioneers from Willa Cather? I'm so thrilled that you mentioned Willa Cather. She's a favorite. Which one is it for you?
You name it. You know, my Antonia, I love. I had, talk about an American moment. One of the things I love to do is just wander around the country, my wife and me. And we were out there, you know, in Cather land, and we went into this pioneer museum, and there was this lovely, very, very elderly woman who used to be a crop duster pilot. And she started telling me how she and her husband used to crop dust, and they'd run out of fuel and float down and land on a country road with their airplane. And I was looking at her books, and I was looking at Willa Cather's books, and she said, "I suppose you like Willa." And I said, "Of course I do." And she said, "I don't care for her personally." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Because she vivisected animals to see how they worked." And I thought that was unnecessary.
I didn't know that about Willa
Cather. I didn't either. And I don't know that I believe it. But you know, she just didn't like that sort of scientific side of her. But what an amazing talent, and what a huge intellect. And, you know, back to my well-worn word, but what a huge spirit.
And what you said about the attention to the good, too.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and she had such a sense of the history of this continent, and the sort of what struck me as the soul of it. You know, there's a passage where she describes the plains and the rolling of the buffalo beneath the plains, you know, those past creatures still stampeding under the grass. It just, that's kind of haunting. It's beautiful.
As I looked about me, I felt that the grass was the country, as the water is the sea. The red of the grass made all the great prairie the color of wine stains, or of certain seaweeds when they are first washed up. And there was so much motion in it, the whole country seemed somehow to be running. More than anything else, I felt the motion in the earth itself, as if the shaggy grass were a sort of loose hide, and underneath it herds of wild buffalo were galloping, galloping.
I noted that you're a fan of Lila Downs. So,
oh, my Lord. Yeah.
I thought we would close with Border. Is that
yes.
Okay?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about what draws you to Lila Downs.
You know, Border itself, the album, I think I've often told people is one of the best books ever written about the U.S.-Mexico border. She's so powerful, and she's kind of a shaman figure, you know. She's intimidating in her range and her bravery, but her kindness, she is all love, even in moments when she's terrifyingly operatic and feels like a thunderstorm coming at you. Her love and her attention, not only to both cultures. I mean, she's like me, you know. She's Minnesota roots and Mexico roots, you know, German and Oaxacan. She understands and she cares, and she would never, I don't think, turn away any American. She's speaking to all of us, or trying to, while honoring the culture that she and I, the two cultures she and I share. So I feel like, you know, maybe she's like a second cousin or something, you know.
Luis, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.